Welcome to Panel by Panel. We take the story arcs of our favorite books and we read them from front to back. Story arcs like Civil War, like DC Crisis on Infinite Earths, like Secret Wars, like you name it, we're going to read it if we haven't already. We take the story arc from beginning to end and we tell you what we like about it, and then you get to be a part of the conversation when we go in depth and break the whole story down. You should have already read and listened to the previous Panel by Panel episode where we covered DC's Crisis on Infinite Earth. Again, joining me today, we're going to go in depth here with Chris Wisdom,
hey.
Mike Woodard,
hello,
and as always, GD himself, George Doro.
Hey, it's great to be back.
I give a big build up. He's like, yeah, shut up, Charles, let's go. All right, so DC, we got big Crisis on Infinite Earths. If you haven't already read it, you need to stop now. You can go listen to the previous episode where we give you the overview, why you should read it, what's great about it, and then come back, because this is the in-depth reviews where we're going to break the story down, tell our favorite parts, tell the favorite spoilers, tell the favorite plot twists, and then wrap it all up in the end. Mike, who's Mr. Context himself, he gives us context of what's going on and what was going on in the world of comics. And you're going to kick it off, take us away for DC Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Okay, here's how to look at it. For the better part of the last year, DC has been introducing a character called the Monitor. And we don't really have a whole lot of fact on who he is or what he's about. He's been kind of shady, literally. In some panels, and he's got a few assistants that we haven't quite met yet, and it's just a matter of, you know, what's going on there. And this is, keep in mind, this is something that DC hasn't done a lot. Some authors in the past have kind of given us that, and it's always been a quick wrap up within 3 to 5 issues. Well, this has been going on for the last 12 issues across a whole bunch of different books. So now on the scene comes this book, Crisis on Infinite Earths. And Chris, I'm gonna take this point to throw it at you, buddy.
Okay. So to start out with, we're introduced to the Monitor's satellite, and we don't know that it's the Monitor. We know that it's the Monitor, but we don't know. Again, he's shady. Exactly. We're introduced to Lila and Lila, who's his assistant. Which, if you've been following DC Comics in those previous years, you've already been introduced to her.
So we see now. I'm the filthy casual in the group. So I open this up, and you all three of you guys have already yelled at me plenty about this. But I see the artwork. I'm like, but I've already established I'm a really weird snob when it comes to art. I very much like what I like and just discard the rest. I'm not saying it's bad artwork. It is actually really good. I can see the detail and the characters and the love that went into this thing. But I had to caution everybody when I start talking about this, because these guys have already ripped me apart for like, what? This is the best stuff.
Well, I was thinking about that since the last episode. And what's the format that you're looking at it through?
Now I am looking at it through a PDF format on my tablet.
Okay. Sometime you have to get your hands on the collected edition, and then you'll see what we're talking about. Because I don't think a PDF is going to do it justice.
And maybe that was it. And maybe so.
Are you talking about the overall quality of the work or the style of the artwork that you don't like?
I think it's mostly the overall quality. The style I got used to, because the style is very much 80s. I mean, it definitely feels 80s. Yeah. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
That style was amazing. You know, we had moved away from the sort of Saturday morning cell animation style of comic book drawing into a lot more detail over the past couple of years. And Perez was the standard bearer for that kind of thing. So, I look upon that style very fondly.
Sure.
It might also be a little bit jarring for him too, because if Charles is coming up through the 90s, I mean, the heroes that he's looking at right now aren't those overly muscularized heroes. The females aren't the overly bosomed heroes. Even Power Girl in this comic book isn't the Power Girl that everybody kind of chastises now for being the breastial representation that she is.
<The breast.
laughs> So So, I mean, it may just be drawing from that aspect that, I mean, the heroes just aren't that 90s Liefeld giant hero that he's accustomed to seeing.
Maybe.
But it was like I told you in between episodes that if you were looking at the actual comic books, the newsprint quality mm-hmm. versus what you have on that PDF, because you've got it really cleaned up. You've got nice, sharp, crisp lines. The colors are immaculate compared to the comics themselves. I'm kind of with the other two. I don't know what more you want.
Yeah, rotten so-and-so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as we open up into this, now here's something I instantly kind of dislike, because I felt like it was a spoiler, knowing mm-hmm. what was going on, is the cover to the collection that I have is older Superman sitting there with Supergirl in his arms dead. And that's the opening cover to the whole collection. I was like,
yeah, it was different than the original book.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. You didn't see that coming in the original book. Well,
right.
No.
What was Chris? Maybe 6 issues in?
That's number seven, I believe.
Number seven.
And the reason that's on there, I'm okay with it, even though that, you know, I knew what was coming, is because that pose is super iconic in comics. I mean, the only time it really happened, the other big time that it happened before then was that Child of Darkness, Child of Light, as the X-Men run with Dark Phoenix. And that was Cyclops holding Jean's body in that same pose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that pose, those two comic books throughout history are the most iconic versions of that pose. And so,
definitely,
I mean,
it's the most well-known cover out of the 12 of this series.
Oh, absolutely.
Didn't we even get that pose for the Death of Robin?
Yes. But I don't think they did it on a cover. It was in the, it was in the comic at the end of, because you're talking Jason Todd, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the panel that everybody voted on.
Yeah.
So it was either happy Batman or sad Batman. We got sad Affleck.
All right, let's steer this back to the monitor.
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay.
So we do open it up and
we see a world dying.
Yeah, you get Pariah is the first thing you really get, the first character you really get.
Yes, yeah. Pariah. And you see this guy that's torn. He knows what's happening, so you get a sense that he's done this before. He tells you flat out, oh my God, I have to watch this again. There's a planet, you just see it dissolving into nothingness. Pariah does what he can to save a person. Like, you can tell he's probably done 100 times before, and that person falls through his grasp. He's not able to do anything because he's affected. The people are affected by their environment in ways that Pariah is not. While he's there to see it, he's still outside of that environment, that reality. And it's heartbreaking to watch this guy that you can see has to relive this over and over and over again. And then even he disappears at the end saying that, okay, I'm being called to another Earth to watch it die.
And if there are heroes trying to save the Earth, then they almost invariably blame him for what's going on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting because it felt foreign to me. Like nowadays, and I don't have any comics to quote it from, to be honest. But I kind of had the feeling that, you know, if we get introduced to a new character nowadays in the comics, all of a sudden the characters don't automatically assume they're the ones doing the troublemaking. It's like, well, let's find out what's going on. Was that something that went on a lot in the 80s, or is it just helping the story get along?
Not necessarily a lot, but keep in mind that this was... going back to something I just said, you didn't see this kind of thing the way you do now. And so this opening was a very good indication of the kind of stakes that we were going to be playing with.
Mm-hmm.
And really the plot point of everybody assuming instantly that Pariah was causing the destruction. I at the time, I remember sort of attributing it to, okay, the only two things happening right now was this guy shows up and everything goes all to hell. Yeah. So, you know, it's a direct correlation. It's an easy assumption. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. And we never quite see the timing on it to see, obviously the antimatter was moving through the universe long before he came. He only shows up. It doesn't seem like he shows up for Ran dying or any other planet dying. He only shows up for Earth's dying.
Yeah, very much. Well, things were pretty Earth-centric.
Mm-hmm. Most things pretty much still are Earth-centric.
Yeah.
when it comes to comics and those kind of things. There was a joke, breaking canon here for just a second. There's a joke with Doctor Who that, holy crap, Bruce Campbell put out himself. That somebody made a poster and he thought it was awesome. He put it out. It's for April Fool's. It was of all, you know, the universe apparently is centered around London, but not anymore. Doctor Who comes to America, and it showed Bruce Campbell as Doctor Who on the poster. And I thought, I was like, oh, that's funny because it's true. Because everywhere we make things, and we make, Marvel and DC are both rooted not only on Earth, but in America mostly. And it took a long time to even branch out stories to the rest of the world. Much less, you know, the galaxy and the universe. So I get that totally. But we get Pariah bouncing around. We get to see different versions of some superheroes, but very quickly. And then it jumps to Harbinger and how she's being sent out. She's two people. She's Lila and then she's Harbinger. Is that about right?
Yes.
And she can actually split her Harbinger persona into avatars of herself.
Yeah, I thought that was a nifty power. I would have liked to have known, I've read the whole thing from the back, but I still would have liked to have known more about Harbinger and her powers and all that, how it was developed. And the fact that she can split not just personas into the galaxy, into time as well, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't know how much of that is her and how much was the monitor's device.
Yeah. Right.
Now, let me ask you guys, I remember at the time making the assumption that her powers tied into the multiverse concept. So in other words, we've got all the different multiversal versions of Harbinger embodied in one person who could peel them off as needed. Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
I like that, sure. Actually. So she as one being is the consistent through all of the realities that she exists in. Yeah, I like that. You're talking to a guy that was, you know, 6 when it came out. So I was just like, oh, wow, this.
yeah. Oh, that's really cool.
I'm along for the story. But I've never really thought about it in that context. I like that explanation.
I can buy that.
Yeah, it's very nice headcanon there. So we still don't know who, at this point, we don't really know who the monitor is. Of course, with the context Mike gave us, we know that, over the last, leading up to it, the previous year leading into this storyline, there had been drops of him in this book and that book and coming across him, probably even face-to-face, it seems like, with some of these comic book characters that they maybe fought him directly at some point. Definitely saw the effects of his guns and movement and all that throughout the universe. But we see him, and he's telling her, go fetch me this character, that hero, and she's going, I don't understand your plan. And he's like, you don't need to just go do it. Because they weren't ready to reveal the whole plan. Perhaps they didn't even understand the whole plan themselves, the writers at the time, and were still hashing it out. But yeah, they weren't able to reveal it. But I did find it interesting that she went back into certain characters that he had her recruit. Then there's the shadow thing that attacks her way in the early formation of one of the Earths. You guys are familiar with that?
Yeah, it was like 45,000 years ago, I think, something like that.
Which is the milieu of Arion, Lord of Atlantis, which was series going on at that time.
All right. And yeah, he was definitely not somebody I was familiar with, but they gave enough context to get through that. But I still don't quite understand. Was it one of the Shadow Warriors that they ultimately reveal later? I'm not understanding. Okay, so that's what you think. That's what took over her.
Yes, it was
Harbinger. That version of Harbinger got possessed by a dark shadow of something.
Mm-hmm. As we learn later, the Anti-Monitor has these minions that are these mm-hmm. shadow demons that he sends out to all the realities and has them pretty much terrorize the populace and attack the heroes that try to defend the world.
Yeah, but they don't seem to possess anybody. I feel like an English fifth grade teacher. Now, why do you think for the story she was able to be possessed?
Well, I think that was on purpose to do the infiltration that we see later on in the book. But I mean, we see as the positive matter universe collapses and the antimatter universe grows in power, you also see these shadow demons grow in lethality.
Yeah, so. Yeah. They seem to grow, gain their power just like the anti-monitor.
As exactly. Yep.
Things grow, they definitely have the power there. So he collects the first major scene that you really see is a bunch of heroes on the space station from different universes that were grabbed by Harbinger, or that came along with Harbinger. Actually, no, I take that back. The first major scene before we get to the satellite station with everybody, you see her getting Psycho Pirate and Firestorm. I'm not sure which Earth it is, but then they go and get Killer Frost, which was an interesting twist on the story instantly for me. I was like, oh, we went from big universal multiverse story to a nice little niche thing that my brain can latch onto and go, okay, I understand who Psycho Pirate is. I understand they're getting Killer Frost to come with them. And, you know, it was an interesting little bit before they got you back into this big, heady space again.
Mm-hmm.
What did you guys think of him making Killer Frost love Firestorm?
It was a little bit on the goofy side, but yeah, it was funny enough.
It felt, from what I remember, the '80s were big. I grew up through the '80s, and I remember big hair being, of course, a big thing, and Dallas being like the number one hit TV show. I mean, it's all everybody talked about then was Dallas and who shot JR and blah, 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 and all that jazz. So very, very much that moment kind of felt along those lines of the society at the time wanted drama. It was a CW at the time almost, right? Yeah. Like you want a little drama, little love triangle thing going on, a little weirdness. But then we get to the station and things are starting to go down. And what happens there?
So we got these heroes who are trying to figure out what's going on, where they are, why they've been brought there. And unknown to them, we see some of these shadow demons start to infiltrate. And then there's a big battle between the Earth representatives, I guess, because not all of them are heroes. There are a few villains thrown in.
Right.
There, which kind of goes back to what the Monitor had been doing previously, supplying arms and weapons to villains. He was, the way they explain it is he was testing their metal to see which ones would be the best candidates for his ultimate plan to protect the Earths.
And that's why Simon didn't want to have anything to do with him, because he wouldn't deal with Simon in that, in that context.
Right.
I'm reading here on the Wikipedia about how there were continuity issues before this. I didn't know this about Superman. Could not originally fly. His strength came from evolving on a planet with stronger gravity than Earth. And he was later depicted flying, with his powers explained as deriving from Earth's yellow sun. So it's very interesting how these things started. Almost on a lark, right? Almost like, we're going to do this. And then they started getting more and more popular, and they started taking on. By the time the 80s came around, I mean, these things were a staple. And not like it is nowadays, but
Superman's interesting because him specifically, it's not just the comics continuity that screwed that up. You can thank Max Fleischer for Superman flying.
Oh yeah,
because that was the animation style. It was easier to depict him flying and just be able to reuse those cells than try to have him continuing to jump like you're used to seeing the Hulk do now.
Yeah, I got
you. And that's so that it kind of spilled over into the comics. They're like, oh, yeah, hey, that makes sense, and it's cool.
And there wasn't a whole lot of planning done back then, too.
Mm-hmm.
But they were pretty cartoons.
Oh.
Yes, they were.
I have them on Blu-ray, and they're one of my prized possessions.
Okay. Yeah. I remember Spider-Man and Friends. And I remember, what was the one that had it wasn't called Justice League, but it had the Legion of Doom in it.
Challenge of the Super Friends.
That's yeah. Back at the Legion of Doom.
Yep.
Yeah, oh my God, that's so good.
Meanwhile, in the Hall of Justice.
Meanwhile, yes.
Ted Grant doing the voice of the narrator too.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just talking about the big battle. I recognize that as a staple of writing, the big battle on the station of, you have bad guys, you have good guys. They're It's starting to turn into that pre-prison riot energy is building up, going, man, don't show me, don't show me. And the good guys don't know why they're there. The bad guys don't know why they're there. They kind of start getting antsy, and they're going to fight each other. And you got to have something bigger than them pull them together, right? Or it will never work. Mm-hmm. And the monitor, from at least at this point what I've seen, he's not powered. He's just smart. Now, I learned later on his backstory. But here's this, he's got, to me, just starting the story, he's got this nice space station. So I knew it wouldn't be him being like, look, I'm a super god. Stop it. And freezing everybody. It felt differently. Well, sure enough, you know, as they start ramping up this energy, then the shadow demons come in. And they start, everybody has to beat the crap out of them. And it's very interesting how they work. Because when they start off, they're not all that powerful. They can kind of burn people when they touch them, and different things is going on. But everybody's able to run them off. And I was thinking, they're shadow demons. What defeats shadows but intense light? And surely there's got to be some hero in this mix that can do intense light. But that's apparently not how they work, because they came out plenty in the daylight later on. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things. But I was definitely thinking along the lines of Blade 3, the movie Blade 3, with the UV light cannons. Like, yeah, yeah. Just call in them. That'll work. So that crisis, that little mini crisis, brought them together. Everybody said, okay. You kind of said they'll work together and this and that. So, man, again, it's moving so fast in this story, because also, because I'm not understanding context here. I mean, I'm understanding the story, but as, like, I'm trying to get in the headspace of the characters, right? So I'm Superman, and here's Lex Luthor. There's, like, three versions of Lex Luthor standing here, yeah? And this guy is telling me that I know he's a bad guy, or recognizes a bad guy. He's telling, or whatever, the monitor is an anti-hero, anti-villain. He's just kind of weird Switzerland-esque kind of guy, feeding his own purposes. But I recognize that. And then all of a sudden he goes, well, here's these shadow demons, and you just fought them. Now we have to go save all the universes because they're dying. He gives a brief explanation. And then everybody's like, okay, we'll go to these planets and work on your machines. It kind of felt like that was a little rushed. But it whatever it is, it worked. And they went to these different planets, and you start seeing the stories of the machines. Who can explain the machines in an easy-to-understand way? Because I didn't quite understand what these machines were supposed to do.
They're a tuning fork, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're going to. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, it's all about vibrational frequency, and that's the. It's, for instance, that's one of the reasons that Flash can, you know, sort of trip from universe to universe. He vibrates at a different rate. So the tuning forks were there to align.
Was that to keep them from? How is that going to keep the antimatter from destroying them?
Well, it's not so much. What I was reading is that later on we find out that the Earths that remain, it's somewhere in the middle of the story, are slowly syncing up their vibrations, and that has the danger to it that if they sync up and become one Earth, then it'll destroy both of them at the same time. So these devices that the monitor planted throughout time and the multiverse were to keep each universe's vibrational frequency separate from the others so they don't overlap.
Yep. Okay. And I think, and to go a little further than that too, is it, for now, that's what it was meant to do. But the monitor's ultimate end game, like he foresaw all this, and you don't get this until like issue 5 or 6 into it, that he foresees this is what's going to happen. So ultimately those tuning forks are not only supposed to keep them separate at the beginning, but once they occupy the same space in the Netherverse, then they can comfortably vibrate all those Earths into one, because you got to remember that that's the ultimate goal of this maxi series here, is to get rid of all of the multiverse. And you come to one universe where one thing, you have one reality.
Okay.
But they were definitely what's the phrase, Deus ex machina?
Yeah,
you know, they were there for multiple purposes, to serve the plot and move it along for a couple different points in the storyline. Mm-hmm. And you know, so their purpose sort of adapted as things went along.
All right,
that's as far as the plot line goes, it was an excuse for sending heroes to all these times and places that have been part of the DC multiverse for so many years. So you get to go back to the Stone Age and meet Anthro. You get to go forward to the time of the Legion of Superheroes, to the Middle Ages where you meet, who was it? Was it Shining Knight?
Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
And this was very much a DC sort of a concept. Every time the Justice Society and Justice League met up, they would have the one big group scene, and then they would pair off into separate adventures. So that you never really had massive group team-ups. It was always, okay, hi, everybody's all in one room for a minute. We got that panel done. Okay, everybody splits off into different chapters now. And this was very much that kind of thing.
Okay, and that's one thing I wasn't aware of.
And it also gave everybody that opportunity. I mean, as George was starting to talk about, that you, not everybody, like Commandy, the last boy on Earth, isn't going to be a pivotal role in this series, but he had a following. So you need to, as you're collapsing all of these different multiverses into one, you need to give people that were accustomed to these characters a chance to say goodbye, or one last shot at saying, hey. Otherwise, they just disappear without ever having referenced them in this maxi series. So when you talk about everything kind of jumps.
To show every character they've ever had at least once, and I can only think of a couple that I couldn't find.
Exactly, yeah. So it definitely helped, or definitely made it harder. So when you see those jumps, Charles, when you're like, I don't know what's going on, that's part of the problem, is there's so much that they tried to do in this.
I gotcha.
And you're not getting the tie-in issues either, where you see things happen outside of.
I was going to bring up. There's a lot happening outside of the 12-issue series.
Now, this thing was 400-and-something pages long. Are you sure they didn't put in the tie-ins to the compendium?
No.
Okay.
No. It's
holy crap, that's a lot of book.
There was a massive amount of tie-ins. Keep in mind, this happened throughout an entire year's worth of books. And as each side adventure happened, that's where those tie-in adventures came into play a lot of times.
Yeah. And even leading up to before Crisis proper printed, Charles, when you were talking about, you didn't have the context for things that were going on and why would they just all of a sudden believe him. And a lot of those tie-ins, you see those people talking about the red skies and the different storm patterns and weather doing funky
things. Where
it
had been building up for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Because, in this story arc, you are very much pariah. You get called in as a reader right when things are going down.
Yep.
So that's what you get, is the last few hours or less on that planet in that universe watching it die.
Yeah. And I think pariah was supposed to be that entry character for the audience.
Sure.
But I'm not 100% convinced that was a successful ploy. I never emotionally connected with Pariah the way I think we were supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that just suffered from lack of backstory. I mean, they gave an explanation for him, but you weren't able to really empathize with him much because you didn't really get to know.
He didn't really get that fleshed out.
Yeah,
no, not at all. And I think that was a function of the pace of this story. Like Charles said in the beginning, it very action-packed. Things just bam, 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 bam. There was no such thing as decompressed storytelling back in that particular day. They had a lot of story to get through, and they didn't waste any time.
I would like to forewarn you, though, Charles, or just be, not necessarily forewarn you, but if you go further, if you go into other crises in the DC continuity, there will be panels that come out of this story that you'll see referenced, and they'll go back to again and again, because they always, all roads lead to Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Well, I do see on the Wikipedia page the pre-Crisis tie-ins and the Crisis tie-ins and then the post-Crisis tie-ins. Yeah, it's a lot of different, I see what you're saying about a lot of different books and lines that really tied in. And what's funny is there's two rows of pre-Crisis tie-ins. Then there's two rows of Crisis storylines, which weren't, you know, the mega series, as you're saying, or the maxi series, but they were the offshoots like you're talking about. Then post-crisis is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that's it. That's all that survived out of. It's like, woo. All right. You know, it's when you do it, you do it. And I get it. So you get introduced a little bit here to Lex Luthor from Planet Earth 3. You know, the new Luthor, the baby Luthor. Luthor Jr., whatever he is.
Alexander.
Alexander. Okay.
Yep.
You see that, and then you see a little bit more of the shadow demons as they're protecting these tuning forks. You see them start attacking the different eras. The one thing I quite didn't see, and again, this might be part of that tie-in, what you're talking about, giving them a chance to say goodbye. There's this offshoot story with this Cro-Magnon man and his village. And he's like trying to steer a herd of stampeding, they're not elephants, they're
mammoths.
Stampeding woolly mammoths. And you're getting multiple panels of this going, oh, okay, this guy is going to play in. They're going to recruit him or something. What's going on here? But it's just a dude. And he's almost like Tarzan-esque. And he does that's change.
That's Anthro.
That's who?
Anthro. That he had his own comic in the, what, 60s?
And then he went on to form a bug killing company, or
Anthro. You're confusing that with Ortho, I take it.
Possibly. you can't fault me for that one. So that was that one of those moments of goodbye because he had been a character that people loved.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. That was one of those fan service moments.
The other stuff I got, you know, Psycho Pirate started messing with people, and this is where Psycho Pirate disappears, right? We see that happening, and the monitor, I love how he's like, well, this isn't quite the worst, but well, damn it. All right, I'm going to go get another one. Yeah, I thought it might happen. I thought it wouldn't be him, but all right, I'll go get another one.
Figure here.
Yeah. Because the anti-monitor takes Psycho Pirate, but Psycho Pirate was living up to his name. He was starting to be a little psycho.
Yeah.
Even on the good guys team, he was starting to really push those boundaries fast. And I was like, holy crap, this is going to be an interesting story. You know, inside the guy's doing good, he's going to kind of monkey wrench that thing up all the way. So he's one of those characters at this point that I'm reading. I didn't know much about him beforehand, but here I'm thinking, well, this is cool. He's one of those characters that no matter – he's a scorpion on top of the alligator, right? No matter how good he knows he needs to be to survive, he's still going to sting you because that's just what he does.
Yeah,
right. And I was like, "Oh, this is gonna be," and then he disappeared. We're like, "Huh? All
now,
right."
Before that happened, I think we need to service the Batman portion of it.
Get that one out and save it, Mike.
If I could just go back just a few pages, real quick.
Sure.
Back to the Anthro thing. So that scene ends with the mammoths eventually showing up in the 30th century.
Right.
Where they cause havoc in the Legion's time, and then they disappear. So the whole point of that was to start demonstrating how these different timelines and Earths are starting to overlap and causing more weirdness. That serves the plot that this is something going wrong that needs to be fixed.
Right. Yep. Now, I totally got that. It was the character of Ortho there that I didn't understand.
Right.
Because I was like, oh, you could have shown elephant stamping, but now I get it. You know, that's why we do the show, to fill in those gaps, if you read like I did. So then, Chris, you were starting to go somewhere.
Right. So immediately following the interaction in the 30th century, then you roll into this Batman story where he's captured. He's fighting the Joker. The Joker gets the upper hand on him with his trick flower.
Yes.
He's got him dead
to
rights.
Awesome.
He's about to blow his brains out. And who comes to stop it?
The Flash.
That's right. Now, this is what we
but
were talking about
the
in the PBS. Well, it is.
Well,
and this
I
is
know.
What we were talking about in the right. Okay. Not on purpose. And this is what we were talking about in BVS, where this is where I read Christ on Infinite Earths.
Immediately. You see him breaking through.
Right. And he doesn't know where he's at because which you'll find out later in issue 8. What's going on with this scene.
And I thought that was great foresight of the authors of the book to put that, because for the longest time, I thought that moment was cool. They reference it another time before we get to see why it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But because when it happens, it's like, Dude, I gotta tell you, as much as I'm a kind of a crabby kindergartner and a fuss about the art a little bit. When I saw the Batman Joker stuff, I was instantly hooked. I was like, oh my God, that was so good. Because I did not read Batman back then. I got introduced to Batman fully with Michael Keaton and the movie in 1987. And then after that, I slowly picked up books. And the biggest book I can remember right now, now I know about The Killing Joke, but I've gone back and read it since. But I think it was Court of Owls was the first real collection I've read with Batman. So that just kind of tells you my backwards history of Batman and how I had to put it together. But I saw this. I was like, oh, this is so cool. Yeah. Really good, really well-drawn Joker, really well-drawn Batman. And then as things are breaking in, here comes the Flash, but he's the Wicked Witch of the West. I'm melting! And it was really weird, but in that way of, oh, this is going to be so good. Hold on tight.
Yeah, it's a good setup and payoff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And Chris, man, let me ask you this, because I think you're most likely to know, but maybe, George, you remember. Did the Flash pop up in that manner in books outside the 12 issues?
Yes.
I seem to think.
He had to have, because the payoff you get later, you see other scenes that you didn't see in Crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wasn't sure I was remembering it correctly or whether I was remembering it the way I wanted to remember it.
No, yeah, it happens out in some of the tie-in books. I want to say it was in the major title tie-in books. So.
And when you saw it outside the 12 issues, it was even weirder.
Oh, I would assume so, yeah.
Right.
Especially if you hadn't gotten to that issue yet or to even see it in that context.
Yeah, there's no clue why it was happening, but you knew it was.
Really got me excited because, you know, honestly, I was reading this thing going, really, Chris? What? Why are you having me reading this? This is just kind of weird and disjointed. That's kind of what I was thinking. I mean, that sounds in my head.
But I'll tell you what I really like about it, and maybe this is why I like so much of the big arcs with DC in the last few years, like Identity Crisis and stuff, because what Crisis on the Infinite Earths did, they did it within the microcosm of the 12 issues, where they would set stuff up at the beginning, they'd set it up well, they'd leave a couple little breadcrumbs, and then at the end, it was all payoff, payoff, payoff. Mm. Mm-hmm. But Identity Crisis, what it was, Meltzer? Was that Meltzer's? I can't remember if that was Meltzer's, so I'm not, don't quote me on the writer. But what he did is he went back through the last 15, 20 years of continuity and found little threads that didn't seem to lead anywhere. And he's like, okay, well, I'll take that. And he led it into his storyline. And that's what the DC writers of today are really good at. Jeff Johns is another one. He goes back and he grabs a little piece that, oh, there's a throwaway moment. Well, I just took it, and now I'm going to put it in this story over here, and you guys are going to think, oh, my God, how have they been planning this for 20 years?
Well, yeah, to redeem myself, I was up until the Flashpoint. I was like, well, not the Flashpoint because it's a whole different story, but the moment of Flash in the book, I was like, I'm going to read this because I promised Chris I would, but I don't get it. I don't get what. And then that moment happened, and I have enough geek and enough knowledge and enough understanding of multiverse and foretelling and foreshadowing and all that. The second the Flash showed up, went, oh yeah, I'm in to the end of this ride now, because that is going to be something, and that's awesome. And just
the horror factor of watching the Flash wither away before Batman, and I mean the emotion that you see on Batman's face, because that's something that's been gone for a while. I mean, Batman's a pretty stern character now. You don't get a lot of emoting out of the man.
That look of shock.
Yeah.
When Flash went, Martha, and he's like, why'd you say that name? It was really a weird moment, but it's cool. No, I'm sorry. But yes, it was drawn very, yes, you see the shock. So even Joker's like, well, this is done. I'm out of here. Yeah. He's like, no longer is he interested in killing Batman. He's like, I'm going to go this way. See you guys. It was very good moment all overall, and it got me very excited about what was going to happen.
One more point before we move forward. Keep in mind that Barry Allen Flash was the Flash for Earth One. Wally West, we only knew him as Kid Flash. And to see Barry in that much jeopardy, you know, in those little Flash moments when he's trying to warn people, or at least, you know, appearing in front of them, we never really believed he was in any major jeopardy. We never, you know, the idea of what eventually happens to him was never anything that I was afraid of. So when the thing, I don't want to spoil it until we get to it.
Happens,
it hit me in the gut even more so because of that.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you consider that the start of the Silver Age is marked with his appearance.
Yes.
His appearance.
Yes, absolutely.
DC very much became, what am I trying to say here? While it didn't start by revolving around the Flash, these guys realized how important Flash was to the evolution of the DC universe and universes. And the choice they made with that character in this series is all the more amazing because of it.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me. I wasn't aware of most of this stuff, and I totally get that. And I knew it was a moment when I saw Flash die. And I found myself going, okay, it's a comic book death. Doesn't matter. So, but wait, this is the '80s. Holy crap. What's going to happen? And I also know that they don't play time like we play time now. You know, if you watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's a episode recently where they start talking about flashes of time, seeing things in the future. And I love that they hammered home the I forget what the physics law is, but basically once you've seen it, it's locked in. Because, and they drew this thing with a stack of paper for 2D people. This is what it looks like to us, but it's always there just waiting for you to get to it. It is a very interesting moment, but I was thinking, that's not how we saw time back then. You know, we didn't understand how it worked. We didn't have these concepts. And so this could be changed. Flash can be saved. Even Batman is going, okay, we got to figure out why this happened and fix it. Yeah. Right?
Yep.
So that helps move on. So where are we with the tuning forks? Because all this is kind of happening all at the same time, and people were getting collected up. I know they went to 3 different worlds. They ended up, did they lose all of them against the shadows?
All but those 3, I think, if I understand your question right.
Yeah, I think you do. So they're losing different ones, but they kept Earth 1, Earth X, and S? The naming of these Earths is weird.
It's, yes. Well, yes. Yeah. Earth S is the easy one because that's the Shazam family.
Okay. But I thought was an interesting concept. I had no clue about that. So as a new reader to that, I was like, oh, that's fun. That's cool. Yeah. I
like that they gave Captain Carrot and the Zoo Crew their own universe.
Mm-hmm.
I forget which Earth it was called, but
I think it was just Earth 5 or something like that. It was
something.
I was thinking it was a Z or a C, but it might be 5. That's, I can't remember.
That sounds right for Zoo.
I don't remember exactly.
But my point is, you know, that somewhere somebody involved decided, you know what, Captain Carrot is just as valid as Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in here and he's going to play a part. Oh. Mm. Loved it.
So. And they did go ahead before we get back to the tuning forks after the Flash instance, because that, you know, pretty early on in this storyline, if you know anything about DC, one of those big questions you should be asking is, well, why is this an issue? Where are the Guardians of the Galaxy?
Oh, yeah.
And that's Marvel, man.
The Guardians of the Universe. The Owens, that, and they answer that pretty quick.
So fill me in, because I didn't know about the Guardians of the Universe. And okay. I was thinking like Owen Wilson, O-W-E-N.
No, the Owens.
O-A-N-S,
yeah.
Gotcha. No, you said it right. Yeah, I just took me a second.
You pronounce it as opposed to when you see it written.
Yes. When you see it written, you get it instantly. Yeah. So talk about them.
So the Owens had taken it upon themselves to, they've seen this issue coming up. They've come together. They're like, we need to go to the power battery. We need to see what we can do about all of this. And a disembodied voice starts speaking to them, lets them know, hey, you're not going to affect my plans. And then all of a sudden energy shoots out of the power battery and takes them out.
Well, it suspends them, right? More or less.
Right. Yep. Yep. Which we find that out later, but in that panel. It looks like you got a bunch of little blue dead dudes.
And that's because that's where we're putting together. That's where, God, what's his name? He's a Lantern, and they obviously brought him back here to be a elite guard or something like that. Not Hal Jordan, the asshole. Guy Gardner. Thank you. Is that the moment you're talking about where they're talking to Guy Gardner and like, hey, you're going to be a guardian of what's going on, and then it kind of explodes? Or does it explode twice?
Yeah, no, this is just them at the power battery on Oa.
Okay. Right. See, I don't have it from me either, but I know the scene you're talking about. It's hard to keep the timeline in order.
That's the scene that you're talking about, Charles, comes much later.
Much later.
Okay, sorry.
And don't feel bad about that. This whole thing is super confusing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why I have you guys. You're keeping it in line. And I should have it in front of me, and I forgot to bring my tablet down with me, so that's my bad.
And one last note before we get on to the thing we're trying to get to, mm-hmm. and I enjoy that we're trying so hard to move on to the next thing and just not able to do it. But I didn't realize at the time, it wasn't until way later on that a lot of the backstory to this event comes from old school, late 50s, early 60s Green Lantern lore. Mm. They didn't make it obvious in this book. And I kind of love that. You know, I love them for it. They didn't spoon feed much of this to us. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing about how the Anti-Monitor was created was very much a part of early Green Lantern lore.
I kind of got that from the first telling of the story before we get to Pariah's telling of the story.
Yeah. Well, and that's another thing that's why I warn you to pay attention to certain panels, because just as Flash is very pivotal to a lot of this stuff, they have also made Green Lantern and the Owens very pivotal to a lot of these things, because you've got the most powerful people in the universe, and then you've got the one guy out of all of the universes that can travel between them when he wants to. It makes sense that those are going to be two of your big cruxes.
Yeah. So very quickly in what we're talking about in these moments, the Anti-Monitor, well, we talked about Psycho Pirate disappearing. He just disappeared in front of people as he was effing with their heads. Yep. We weren't supposed to be. And what night was it? There was some Iron Knight or whatever it is. He's like, he makes some quip I thought was good. I can't remember what it was, but when the guy disappears, like, oh, essentially in their own version, like, oh, well, that happened. it was well written. I just can't remember what the quip was. It was good. But so he's at the Anti-Monitor, and we find out very quick, and we never see the Anti-Monitor's face or what's going on, and he's there. And then they kidnap Flash. This is after you see the Flash melt, right, with Batman. Anti-Monitor captures Flash and keeps him there, and he says, Psycho Pirate, you have at him. Keep him under control. And Psycho Pirate goes in with the fear aspect of it all, which is interesting. Because it brings up that age-old question, which is more powerful, fear or love? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember how Robert De Niro put it, but I think it's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. He put it very well about it's better to be loved than to be feared, but if you can't have love, then get fear. Blah, blah. Anyway, so Psycho Pirate is controlling the Flash. We see all this stuff going on. So he automatically took him out, and he stated, the Anti-Monitor states, what you just said, Chris, about we can't have him hopping across universes and ruining my plans now, can we? So they're doing that. Now, what was the point of the Red Tornado capturing him?
Well, Red, you just jumped.
Did I jump too far?
Yeah.
Again, I don't have it in front of me.
No, you're good. Yeah, I just don't know. You're about four or five issues ahead, so I don't know where we're...
So Mike... Or George, why don't you two bring us back in where we lost all but a few of the tuning forks. He already took out Flash. Cause I know Flash was early on. He grabbed Flash right after he grabbed Psycho Pirate, it seems like.
Yeah.
So where do we go next?
Let's see.
I think next is where they all come back and new heroes are brought into the station before the thing happens with Harbinger and the Monitor.
Well, this is a point where a lot of, like you said, new guys pop up. And a lot of the new characters that are going to have a place in DC Universe ongoing, this is where we first see a few of them. Yeah.
Okay. Because I know they're continuously grabbing more, recruiting more. Oh, I did love the lines that I think it came more later, but there was a little bit early on of, everything's dying. Universes are dying. But you can go think about it for a few minutes. Go back to your Earth. Come back and let us know. But you only got a little bit of time. Like, no, you need to know now, dude.
Yeah. Well,
you
and that was
understand
that,
or not.
That was at Superman Earth 2 Superman's behest. He was like, look, I already know I'm on board, but these guys, some of these guys need a little more convincing. Let them go back, and whoever wants in can be in. So,
it's, and that. But in this particular rise, either you're in or you're dead.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
The bottom line. So we're back at the station, right?
Yeah.
And
yes, after the tuning forks have been lost, or those that were lost, yep.
And if I remember correctly, as we're watching the tuning fork stuff happen, you know, the battles, the wins, the losses, we're also seeing Alexander, baby Alexander on that Earth. It's, which was that? God, I know there's an Earth Prime somewhere, or maybe that's later in DC.
That's later.
Damn it.
And you only need to worry about one guy on Earth Prime. That's it. So that's it. That's easy.
Okay. So on one of the Earths, Luther is, it's almost the storyline that I keep calling Red Sun, but it's not Red Sun, of where the L's, the Luthers became L's, which was shortened to EL, which became Kal-El later in the future, and they send the Superman back in time and not through space. It's almost that aspect where Lex Luthor is the Kal-El of the world, of that Earth.
That's Earth 3, okay. And that's what you see lost in the beginning panels of the first issue.
Okay, yeah. So. And see him shoot the baby. Ow, not shoot the baby, but shoot the baby out in space.
As far as that particular Luthor goes, the best way to think of him is to think of him as the anti-Luthor. You know, good Luthor versus bad guy Luthor versus, well, not necessarily versus, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
And that Alexander. So,
and on that Earth, the heroes were the villains. So you got Ultraman instead of Superman and
Owlman versus
Owlman. Yeah.
Johnny Quick. Power
correct
Ring.
Me if I'm wrong, but they were introduced in the 60s as well.
Yeah, they were part of the Charlton comics group that DC absorbed.
Okay.
If I remember that correctly. Because, yeah, that's way back.
Mm-hmm. But, way back.
But anytime you're dealing with Luthers, you're dealing with, you know, behind the scenes machinations. So, a lot of the middle part of Crisis is kind of muddled in my head. I'll freely admit to that. There were things going on there that I sort of read my way through at the time, but looking back on it, I'm not 100% clear on. You know,
yeah, I just read it over this past week, and I'm with you there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was very much a point of, okay, we had a strong vision for how we wanted to start this, and we have a very strong vision of where we want to end up. And all of this middle stuff is just sort of maneuvering the chess pieces so that we get our end game in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I kind of got that feeling as well. So if I'm incorrect, I think there are three acts to this.
Yeah.
And the end of the first act essentially is where the Anti-Monitor reveals himself.
Yes. I would agree with that.
But. Yeah. Did he do that before he took the Red Tornado?
It was within a couple panels of each other, because that was the last panel of the comic book, and where he reveals that he has the Red Tornado and he's got the Flash.
Okay, so let's move to that so we can move into Act Two, which is more of the go after him because we start understanding. So
you're talking. So issue four, that's a good spot because that's where the possessed Harbinger,
yes,
finally takes enough control that she kills the Monitor.
Right. So, and you see that the Monitor says, you know, in a monologue to himself, basically, or to the he's recording tapes, I guess it is, that he knows the plan, and it is almost comics, man. They really rely on the Jesus stories a lot. It seems like at different times and different places. Maybe because it's the most told story throughout history. I don't know that why it plays in exactly that way. But this was one of those where he basically knew he had to sacrifice himself for the plan to work, because he knew that she was going to be somehow. He knew she was going to be possessed. Somehow he knew that she was going to have to kill him. But in order to do so, he was already had this other plan going. He's like the ultimate Luther here, and had plan on top of plan on top of plan. So we already know. it's coming. And then we already see her struggling with it, which I thought was a nice touch of both sides of that story being told in a panel or two here and a panel or two there. Mm-hmm. That was fun. So that's building up to the end of Act One, right?
Yeah. And I felt like once that point hits, you know, once where we realize that the monitor knew that his death was, for lack of a better word, inevitable. I felt like a lot of the early stuff we saw him do that we didn't understand began to make a little more sense.
Yes. We know he rescued Harbinger as a child from somewhere. I'm not sure if he gave her powers or how that worked out. But then we see him rescue Alexander, the baby, as he's mm-hmm. coming out of the Earth 3 universe. And so those are nice little pieces that we don't know what are going on until we see why they're going on. So you want to just talk about you said it already. So she, yeah. the possessed Harbinger built up enough control that she murdered the monitor. Did I miss the panel? Because I got the effect of it. And I got, you know, they even expound on that in the story a little bit later of the moment she kills him. Somehow he releases all his power into his machines.
Yep, into the tuning forks.
Okay. And that pulls them, it pulls the three Earths into a pocket universe.
Yeah, into the what they call it, the Netherverse, I believe. Yeah, the Netherverse.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the plan. Was he yes. had to die to release his power to be able to trigger all that to happen.
Yeah, and it has to do with Alexander Luther, too, because they allude to yes. it a little bit when you're introduced to him as a baby, but the illustration, visually, it's not, I don't think there's enough because it looks too much like shading versus he's a conglomerate of positive matter and antimatter
right.
in one being, and that's where he becomes the safe haven. He's able to, he has access to this Netherverse. He can access it.
Right, he can access everything. He's Visa. He can get everywhere you are. And I like the accelerated growth and how the monitor's, you know, grooming him basically very quickly to do what he needs to do. And then once the monitor's dead and Harbinger is now free of the dark whatever, he comes out of the shadows and going, "This is how it had to happen."
Yeah.
And now here's why. And then we get Richard Simmons. I was like, oh, this is the 80s. There you go. Perm boy. All right. Moving on. And I totally gave that one to him. It was a sign of the times. I mean, I get that. But I very much saw in that, not so much Richard Simmons, although that was a funny thought in my head. I can't remember any of the rock and rollers during that time, but I totally got that vibe. He's supposed to be the young, hip rock and roller person, but it's 1985, end of 84, early 85, somewhere in there. So it's really perm guy with a jumpsuit. So it was fun.
Can't it just be a Luther finally got hair?
No wonder they're bald if that's what their hair does. So
all the Lex Luthers have had red hair to begin with, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah. Most, yep.
Yeah. I don't know.
Because that's the original, isn't that one of the original reasons that Luther hates Superman is because yes. back in Smallville,
yep.
it was an experiment that he screwed up and Superboy saved him from, but he put the blame on Cal.
Yeah. Well, I was a total Reed Richards, Dr. Doom
thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Trope, definitely. Yeah.
And because we all know redheads have no souls, that's why he's a supervillain.
Yeah.
The very end of Act One, the anti-monitor reveals his face in a dun-dun-dun moment. And I just went, great googly moogly. What the hell did you all draw here? Wow. That was very interesting how they chose to portray him, right? You see the monitor as, man, the monitor is almost the Dos Equis guy, right? He's just this groomed man with a nice square jaw, and he exudes wisdom and strength when you see the monitors. And the anti-monitor is like, holy crap, I just pooped myself. What is wrong here? What did y'all get out of that? At the time that you read it, when he turned around, was it a dramatic moment for you?
Yeah.
I like the design of the character. I thought it was a really really cool, really villainy looking monstrous creature. So, yeah, I enjoyed that part.
Okay, cool. Cool. I'm reading through this stuff. So there's still two more Earths out there to pull the rescue, right? They're racing to get the last two remaining Earths.
Three.
So, no, we saved three.
No. We saved two. There's three left out there.
Okay.
Because at the crux of this, there should be five.
Yes, at the crux there is five.
So they just took care of Earth 1 and 2. That's what just went into the Netherverse at the end of Act 1. So then there's the three others out there, S, X, and...
Four.
Four.
Ha, because I'm reading the wiki. it's an anti-monitor recruit psycho pirate, but it gives him the power to control these Earths. And he promises him he'll have his own new universe to control and this and that and the other. It was very interesting to see that stuff. So Act 2 would be, I would say, as summary of Act 2 that we're going to get into depth here is, oh, okay, now we get what's going on. We have to go out here and rescue these other Earths, and we have to go after Anti-Monitor at the same time. Mm-hmm. Is that about right?
That hits it for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's so many different stories. What do we want to tackle here going after the rescue of the Earths? Chris, are you on track? You good here?
Well, to start with, you've got the Anti-Monitor amplifying Psycho Pirate's powers, and mm-hmm. not only does he have everybody, all the normies on these Earths freaking out and just trying to jump into antimatter, but he has the heroes attacking each other.
Yes, I do remember that. Yes.
So, I mean, he's got them fear and rage at anybody that's trying to help stop things. So that's where you go. You've got on Earth S, you have the Shazam family attacking Supergirl and Wonder Woman.
Great fight scenes across the universes with different mm-hmm. heroes, for sure. How did they break his hold? Because they do break it. I just don't remember what happened to shake that control that he had.
Yeah, it was, I want to say, it seemed like he got burnt out, actually. I don't quote me. Give me just a second.
Yeah, he was overwhelmed by all the emotions and
Psycho Pirate was.
Yeah. Because even Flash was starting to break free and he was right there.
Well, Flash breaks free at the end of Act 2. More or less.
No, not break free from the Anti-Monitor. He breaks free from Psycho Pirate's control.
Oh, yeah, because Psycho Pirate is still trying to control him, and he's constantly having to fight that control. I got you. So, okay, now we're in Act 2. Talk about the damn Red Tornado. I don't understand. I mean, I understand who Red Tornado is. He's an android. He can turn into a tornado. I'm not sure if he can control weather as a whole.
And that's what the Anti-Monitor explains. He's like, he's more than anyone has ever realized that he is. He's the embodiment of this. He's a force of nature.
Okay.
So everything that you talk about, like these the red skies and the weather patterns on all these Earths, that's the Red Tornado can affect that. So everything that's happening on the Earths prior to that has to do with the entropy and the antimatter portals opening up and destruction from those, mm-hmm. but he can cause that in the matter universe by just unleashing the Red Tornado's power, his true power,
which he does build up. I mean, as soon as he gets him, he like turns him into this, I wouldn't say a ball of energy, but I don't know how to describe it, how it's drawn on the page, mm-hmm. but essentially deconstructs him a little bit, which looks quite painful, and starts mixing up things. And then during these battles, we see, is it on all the Earths or just one of the Earths that he unleashes the tornado?
I think it was just the one Earth where Blue Beetle was.
Yeah, Ted Kord making an appearance. Mostly just holding back the ship going, holy crap, let's not fly into that.
Well, Ted Kord was saying, let's fly into it. It was Martian Manhunter.
That's true.
And Block saying, no, that's a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, you can tell he's kind of fighting because I know we don't need to go over there. But I just feel like I have to go over there.
Yeah,
it's very interesting. You see people start, or see heroes start saving other heroes and stop. You start saving normal people and those things. Act two is very, felt very quick. Like act one felt like a huge setup, mm-hmm. right? And act two felt very quick of, all right, we stopped these Earths. Now, did they rescue all five or did they lose one?
And that's when you finally see Psycho Pirate just completely lose it all, because that's when Lila, Alexander's going to implement a plan to get all five of them together. And then Lila sacrifices her Harbinger powers and she channels everything. So now they have all five of the Earths existing in the Netherverse, and it's outside of the control and the influence of the Anti-Monitor and Psycho Pirate.
When does the station blow up? Because I feel like it blows up right here.
It's about that time.
Alexander was implementing his plan to pull in the other three, and it strained, and they were under attack at the same time, and it strained like the resources of the station or something, and it exploded.
Yeah.
And he used his power to protect everybody.
Yeah, it was at the beginning of that.
Okay.
So at the end of this issue is when everybody is, all five Earths are in the same Netherverse, but at the beginning of that same issue is when the satellite explodes.
Now, there was a great line in there with him. I think it's Lila and maybe one other person, Pariah, I think. They're standing on this rock looking down at the Netherverse and going, we did it. Now, how do we get off this rock? Yes, how do you? Because I was thinking that. I was like, this is so dumb. How do you get off? Oh, no, you wrote that on purpose. And then that must have been handled in one of the offshoots, because I never got an answer to that question. I want to know how they got off the rock. I thought it was a fun moment. What do you remember here, George?
Okay, so you're talking about where we got the representatives of the remaining Earths and Alexander Luther discussing their next move.
Yes, you got the five Earths in. You start getting this explanation of they're starting to merge into one universe, and that's bad, mm-hmm. and they're holding them off. Alexander used some kind of power to help hold them off, but they're slowly sliding into each other anyway.
And yes. Here's where we get into what I think Mike was alluding to earlier, where we get the origin of the DC multiverse involving the ancient Owens. And Krona, whose sole driving motivation was to view and understand the beginning of the universe. And it's explained there, well, explained is a really strong word to use for what they did there, that his viewing the universe is what caused the creation of the multiverse.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the mechanism is for that, but you know, it's one of those, this is how we're plotting it, go with it kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you can have problems with it in this story, and it's okay because it just serves a purpose of, yes. It serves the story's purpose.
Oh yeah. The
payoff for that whole backstory comes later with later crises.
And again, a nice payoff.
Yeah.
Was that in this book or was that later?
No, like later, later. Zero Hour references it. Infinite Crisis goes back to it.
Okay, so in our wrap up, we can kind of come back to the
payoff. Oh, so it has reverberations in further storylines.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, very cool.
Okay, that is cool. That's good to know. And I do know that they conditioned it a little bit with ancient legends say, if you see the beginning of the universe, it will destroy the universe. You know, they just kind of, we don't have anything better. We just need something to crux this to get us to our next point. And it worked okay to me. It worked fine. Okay, I can go with that. You know, I can go with ancient legends. I love how he sees the hand coming out of the universal ooze. I'm not even sure mm-hmm. what we're looking at. And in that moment, that's when they split. The universe is split. Is that when it split to matter, antimatter?
Yes.
Or is that okay? So that it split there, yeah. And that made the multiverses.
Yes.
And somehow these beings were created. Were these primordial representations of their respective universes, the positive monitor and the
antimatter
anti-monitor.
Right.
Yep. And they battled for centuries, eons,
10,000 years. Or, yeah.
Until they both gave each other the KO hit.
Yeah. Yes. And then it kind of subsided for a long time. So that was interesting. I liked a better payoff a little bit later when we talk about Pariah, and we'll get there, and that's in the third act. So we get that set up, and we get strike teams built, right?
Yes.
And was it Alexander who – I think it is Alexander who opens the portal for them to go out into the monitors, anti-monitors universe, to go to his base of stone.
Yes. Right. Yep. Out to Quard.
And you start – that was actually one of my favorite parts. So they fly in. It's a great – you can see like where the monitor built the station and kind of got away from the universe, or you know, from everybody's kind of hidden. And you see the multi – the matter multiverse. And the antimatter verse is not a multiverse. It's just the one thing. And so it's like the anti-monitor never left. He stayed right on the edge of the universe with that planet and just built everything right there. And you see this huge, colossal stone planet, really. I mean, the whole thing is his base. And as they start, as the heroes start progressing into it, you see it's alive.
Yep.
And that was really cool. They start battling basically stone golems. And
yep.
It's and because it's antimatter, their powers start working differently, which I didn't think see coming until it happened. Oh, yeah, that makes total sense, because why would Superman, Supergirl, super name it here, why would that work the same? It's mm-hmm. the antimatter universe. You should have a flip of something. Now, glad they weren't powerless, because that would have been a wow, that's over. Okay, what's next? Because you know, if they become powerless, they'll die instantly, and that wouldn't work.
Yeah, anti-monitor wins, everybody dies, blah, blah, blah.
Which, honestly, I know people would be like, what the F, man? But that would be an interesting way just to end your company. DC knows it's closing its doors, so they built up this whole thing. It's like, nope, anti-monitor wins, sorry. And we're like, what? Yeah, we filed Chapter 13. We're not going to be here anymore. My bad. We apologize for nothing. But that's, of course, not how it went. Now we're building up to one of we're building up to the biggest crux moments. Was the Flash incident at the end of the second act or the end of the third act?
No, well, it's coming up. I mean, you get
yeah, I thought so. It's in this issues. It's in this battle section. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Because in issue 7, 8, you get a big left, right punch from the writers.
Okay. Well, I don't quite remember it, but what? Yes, go ahead.
Oh, nothing. I was just bad mouthing the writers.
So let's build up to the Supergirl incident. So the supers, we got, how many supers do we have? We have Supergirl.
Yep.
We
Superman,
have
Superman Earth 1, Superman Earth 2.
Which is, you know, young Superman and old Superman.
Yep.
Which I found very, again, thank you for explaining that these things were handled in offshoot stories. Because I was thinking in this moment going, wow. You guys are really cool going, hey, you're me. No, you're me. And you're all cool with it. You're not freaked out at all.
Well,
so I'm assuming that was handled elsewhere.
That is one of those. Remember, we talked about in the overview episode that they used to do a once a year crossover with Earth 1, Earth 2 people. So Superman is one of those consistent ones that he.
Obviously, Flash,
he has an analog on both worlds, and it's the same person. See, a lot of the confusion that they tried to clear up. Or continuity inconsistencies, was Barry Allen, just like in the Flash TV show, Barry Allen knew who the Flash of Earth 2 was because he was reading the Flash comic books from the time that he was a kid. So he knew it was Jay Garrick. The problem is, when you look at it continuity-wise, is if Earth 2 is in the comic books that Barry Allen is reading, then doesn't Barry Allen know that Superman is Clark Kent? Because the Superman of Earth 2 is also Clark Kent. And so if... Oh, go ahead.
Way too deep.
Yeah. No, I just,
come up for air, Chris. Come up for air. You're
but that's
you're
that's one
there.
Of those things that they were trying to clear up, because it seemed like if Earth One had a comic book series that told you the secret identity of Superman, and it's the same person, it's not a different guy, it's not a
right.
Jay Garrick versus a Barry Allen, then how do you explain that? But no, so these guys are used to seeing each other.
Okay.
They have met prior to.
All right. I did find it interesting how they referenced each other. One would always be called Kal-El. The other one would be called Clark.
Or Kal-El with an E is the newer Superman, and Kal-El with just an L.
Yeah, that doesn't really work except when you're reading it.
Right.
Right. But again, at the time, there were no real TV shows. There were barely cartoons. Mm-hmm. So that was fine. You know, that was a, the word trope kind of feels out of place here, but that was a good trope that would work because you knew it was only going to stay here on paper. Mm-hmm. And that was fine. So we're battling the rock golems. And I remember the three supers. I know there's some other. Oh, they played a lot with Dr. Light in this. Like, she mm-hmm. was a huge deal. And I do know of Dr. Light from what little I know of the DC Universe. I found her story very interesting. The story arc, she was, to me, because here, maybe I latched on because it's the only story I read. But to me, she was a scientist who was like, poo-poo on you, person. And her,
she's a real...
yeah, there you go. And then Monitor funneled the power of Dr. Light into her. Triggered it somehow, whatever. He helped with that. And then Harbinger brought her back. So on, so. But the whole time she was like, F you guys, I mean, constant. Mm-hmm. And they kept convincing her to come along. So if, to me, she's like, oh, I can understand you developed your character here, and I see her progress through the whole story arc. So I want to say thank you to DC for giving me that to latch onto, because it helped keep me in this universe of everything's going sideways, and I don't know who everybody is. And oh, at least I can follow you. You're new, and I can follow you. So that was cool. I think she was playing in here. But again, I love the non-team dynamic going on. Because it's so easy. You see it happen too many times in too many stories, not just comics, but TV, movies, where you don't really have a reason to be a team, but all of a sudden you are, and now you work perfectly together. No. And here's this. I mean, here, Dr. Light's taking off, Supergirl's doing stuff. You know, there's no team dynamic. Everybody's just kind of doing their thing. It causes some chaos.
And this is the point where we're going to take a break, but we're only halfway through. So grab yourself a quick snack, walk around the room a little bit, get some exercise, and then grab part two of Panel by Panel's in-depth look at Crisis on Infinite Earths.